son. Apropos of rising generation, let me return to the old fogies motif just for a moment. A number of members of the rising generation have been unkind enough to ask me, why don't I retire? After all, in today's tight academic market, it would be an act of mercy, kindness, and so on. And if I retired, for goodness sakes, you could hire two assistant professors at tolerably good salaries. Well, I'll come to that in just a moment. It's not the money. You know, University of Alabama, believe it or not, the state of Alabama in some ways is a very progressive state. And we have three retirement systems, right? Three different things. And when people retire from the University of Alabama, their income goes up about 30%. So that has nothing to do with it. Now, I will admit that, you know, I've been at it a long time, and the academic grind is finally getting to me. You know, those of you who are academicians know this. 6 hours a week you gotta work, no? Every week. Except, of course, for 4 months off in the summer and 3 weeks off at Christmas, and otherwise it's unrelieved except for spring vacation. The reason I don't retire, at least not just yet, is that I have been very blessed to have, right now, two of the three best graduate students I've ever had. One of them is sitting over there, Steve Klugwitz. Second, the other is Adam Tate, who could not come because of prior commitments. And I've got to see them through until they have their degrees. The third, I said there were three, two of the three, is sitting right here, Lenore Ely. Lenore is a phenomenal person. She got her undergraduate degree in science education at Auburn University. Now, if this were an Alabama audience, you would go boo hiss. But anyway, she then went and she taught science in high school in a little hick town up in northwestern Alabama for a while. And at some point along the way, it occurred to her that there's got to be something better than this. And so she decided to come back and get a graduate degree in history. Totally different field. I suppose she would probably have gone to Auburn, except Auburn is down in the southeastern part of the state, and the University of Alabama is in the central western part of the state, and so it was a lot easier to commute and stuff. So she showed up there, and we just dropped our jaws because she was so bright. She got her MA at the University of Alabama in history. Her field, her of greatest interest, was 17th century England, and particularly political thought in 17th century England. And we simply do not have the personnel to have taken her on through the PhD. So we sent her off to Johns Hopkins, and she took her PhD at Johns Hopkins and wrote what I regard as a brilliant thesis. She thinks it's kind of dull, but anyway, she's reworking it to make it less so. One more thing to say about Lenore. Yesterday, Ellis Sandoz quoted John Maynard Keynes, though he didn't mention Keynes, as in the famous comment that in the long run, we're all dead. All right. John Maynard Keynes was a homosexual, and in the long run, he's dead. All right. In the long run, I ain't dead, right? Because I got kids, and I got grandkids. And this summer, I'll have a great-grandchild, right? And there's a moral there. I mention this because if you will notice very, very carefully as Lenore gets up and comes up here to the microphones, that she is with child. And it's due September the 16th, and I've been trying to persuade her to hold off for one day, so it'll be born on Constitution Day, September the 17th. But anyway, Lenore Ely.
With a setup like that, I'm not sure I want to be up here for the next 20 minutes, but I'd like to thank John Wilson and Bill Campbell for inviting me to be here today. I'm just going to warn you, if you get a message from John and he says, "Dear, your name, old buddy," watch out. Today, the topic that they suggested we speak on was the conservative mission in the 21st century. I'm educated as a historian, and I'm not particularly inspired as a prophet or a visionary, so I find this a bit of a daunting task, especially since Ellis Sandoz reminded us yesterday that we're all trapped behind the Iron Curtain of the future. So it's with trepidation that I try to speak a little bit to the future, but I've given the question some thought, have some idiosyncratic notions to share with you this morning that I hope will at least provoke some questions and discussion at the end of the session. I suppose I'm going to reveal a little bit of my liberal progressive tendencies by showing you how much I like to read outside of the canon. So I hope I also will introduce some thinkers or bring them back onto your radar screen in my talks that maybe we don't talk about enough as conservatives. I want to begin by giving us a definition of conservatism. As I'm considering it in the remarks that follow, it's not a comprehensive definition or certainly even fully descriptive, but I think we need a jumping off point. I suspect in this room we might all give a different definition of conservatism, so I want to bring us all to the same page if possible for the next 20 minutes. It's this: conservatism is a mode of political thought whose proponents seek to appropriate the best traditions of the past as a guide for ordering society in the present and the future. In contemporary America, conservatism in practice encompasses a wide variety of traditions that are celebrated and, because they are sometimes in tension with one another, contested. We can say of all strands of American conservatism, however, that they generally share a concern with the practice and preservation within our political culture of the complementary goals of human liberty and responsibility. We can also say, I believe, that conservatives embrace a respect for the dignity of human life and thus are also concerned with the goals of equality and justice as realized through widespread economic opportunity and the rule of law. Over the past couple of days, we've had a great deal of discussion about the prospects for conservatism and its cultural seedbed, Western civilization, at the close of the 20th century. This morning, we're taking time to reflect on these discussions and to think about the conservative mission in the future. To get us started on that discussion, I'd like to suggest that the conservative mission in the future will need to be organized around three themes: roots, relevance, and recreation. So let me elaborate on these themes. As a mode of thought, and perhaps also as a temper of spirit, conservatism is not something that future generations can embrace on the basis of sensory perception of physical beauty. I love wordplay, and I was thankful to the speaker yesterday who reminded us that optimism is tied to the optic nerve, the things we can see, and suggested that we might need hope rather than mere optimism. But we cannot hope that our children will wander through the cultural and political landscape and automatically choose our mode of thought or our most revered traditions merely on the basis of their beauty to us. The virtues of conservatism are founded in intellectual virtues, which means that we must intentionally set about the intellectual labor of describing the foundations of our thought and practices in ways that explain our own commitments and choices to succeeding generations. These foundations are the roots of conservatism, or as Russell Kirk put it, the roots of American order, and they are found in the histories, philosophy, economics, and other great literature that conservatives cherish, consult, and debate as their guides. I include the term debate here intentionally, and I believe it is critical that we continue not only to recognize and respect the sources of our own commitments, but also to debate them. To avoid the errors of what has been called Whiggish history or historicism, or more simply, self-righteousness, we must constantly remind ourselves that history has not led inexorably to us, but that we stand where we do today as the result of human choice, human action, and indeed human sacrifice. History is a realm of moral freedom and responsibility. One of the most eloquent expressions of this truth, which I hope all conservatives do affirm, was stated by the British historian Herbert Butterfield. "Our final interpretation of history," Butterfield reminds us, "is the most sovereign decision we can take, and it is clear that every one of us, as standing alone in the universe, has to take it for himself. It is our decision about religion, about our total attitude to things, and about the way we will appropriate life. And it is inseparable from our decision about the role we are going to play ourselves in that very drama of history." I think Butterfield's sentiment there really relates very closely to the kind of sentiments that we were introduced to yesterday with the thoughts of Christopher Dawson and Eric Voegelin, and that religion is really the seedbed that gives rise to culture. While I believe that conservatives must respect the individual's need to make this sovereign decision, I think it's fair also to say that conservatives believe that this sovereign decision need not be made in the vacuum of the individual mind. In our infatuation with the power of the human mind, we moderns are tempted to believe that man's mind can displace God as the creative intelligence of the world. Whitaker Chambers reminded us, however, that this was the temptation of communism. Chambers stood witness to the truth that true freedom is a need of the soul. And in his short letter to my children, he revealed that his testimony was intended above all to remind his children that their journeys, though sometimes dark, are deeply rooted in his own and in every honest man's search for truth. The need for roots, to borrow the anglicized title of a compelling little book by Simone Weil, demands that we extend our hands to future generations by attending to their education. By education, I mean here not indoctrination, and certainly not even the mere persuasion that our own mode of thought is the most expedient, nor even the most useful. Rather, I mean that education which involves introducing the next generation to the best traditions that our civilization has to offer, without glossing their shortcomings or denying the ongoing challenges that we face. I also mean that education in which we demonstrate that the virtues we have chosen to pursue for ourselves and would wish for our nation reflect our love of reality, our respect for truth, and our awareness of beauty in a right ordering of private and public lives. The question of education leads to my second theme, which is relevance. Of late, conservatives have been much caught up in what have been called the culture wars. These contests have typically been waged in our educational institutions and have consisted in part in the effort of conservatives to resist the tendency of the schools to teach students that all truth and all values are relative. For cultural and moral relativists, values are merely arbitrary personal convictions that can bear no universal compulsion on the mind of man. Although this teaching of relativism is often made in the name of liberty, this liberty is a liberty of self-creation, and it's accompanied by what some call an ethic of authenticity. One danger of relativism is that it tends to undermine a young person's interest and confidence in cultural, moral, and intellectual traditions long proven by both reason and experience to be worthy of our submission. Taking as a given the current influence of relativism on rising generations, I believe that conservatives must not only know the roots of our own beliefs, but that we must also be capable of making these beliefs relevant to the rootless individuals around us. There are essentially two key tasks involved here. One is the reconstruction of educational institutions throughout our society that are capable of cultivating understanding and appreciation of our roots among the majority of American youth. This, of course, is no small order. But I believe, as John suggests, there are people that are doing this now, and we need to encourage and support those movements. They're pointing the direction, and we need to follow and help. The second task, I think, is the more formidable, and I believe that there are fewer guides to this task. This is the reconstruction of an educational philosophy that can reach out to those who have not had the benefit of a sound education and to help them overcome their detachment from the roots of American order. We must somehow discover a way to enable American citizens once again to commit themselves to the civic and political and social institutions so vital to the flourishing of our culture. This way must rest on an epistemology that can counter the relativist claims. I believe the work of the scientist and philosopher Michael Polanyi may offer us the most direction here. Polanyi's very acute analysis of the origins of the modern mind echoes the witness of Whitaker Chambers. Polanyi describes the terrain of the modern mind in this way. A new destructive skepticism is linked here to a new passionate social conscience. An utter disbelief in the spirit of man is coupled with extravagant moral demands. We see at work here the form of action which has already dealt so many shattering blows to the modern world, the chisel of skepticism driven by the hammer of social passion. But rather merely than repudiate modern critical philosophy or deny the passions unleashed by the 20th century utopian ideologies, Polanyi attempted to push past the problems they posed for the coherence of the human mind. In his books, The Logic of Liberty, which was recently republished by Liberty Press, so you can get a nice little volume fairly inexpensively, and more comprehensively in Personal Knowledge, Polanyi lays down epistemological grounds that restore the possibility of intellectual and moral commitment, and even require it. Through his philosophy of personal commitment, Polanyi affirms the need for the learner, or what he calls the discoverer, to pursue questions that are relevant to his own concerns, but for which he seeks solutions that are satisfying and compelling both for himself and everybody else. Polanyi observes a mutual correlation between the personal and the universal that has not been admitted by modern epistemology, with its tendencies to err either in favor of a radical subjectivism on the one hand or a wholly impersonal objectivism on the other. The need for relevance approaches the deepest foundations of liberty, which for Polanyi is a measure of the extent to which we are enabled to honor the invisible things which guide our creative impulses and in which our consciences are naturally rooted. For Polanyi, a nation whose citizens are sensitive to the claims of conscience and are not afraid to follow them is a free nation. So the business of cultivating and honoring conscience must therefore be the end of any true liberal education. It matters not whether the education is public or private, but whether the state can refrain from hindering the transmission of social lore, which Polanyi believes can only be done by a vast array of specialists, each dedicated to their own personal callings. Polanyi's philosophy, I believe, thus offers us a means of living relevant lives within the seeming tensions between the universal and particular, between civic and private life, between political unity and the social diversity which very much enriches our culture. So we need both roots and relevance, but in order to renew the relationship between the traditions of our past and the needs of our present and future, we must also attend to the process of recreation. While conservatives are often busy conserving and preserving, we often fail to realize that we have to also be engaging creatively with the demands of the present. On this point, the British philosopher Michael Oakeshott has been the most eloquent, assuring us that a society requires not only that its civilization should be guarded, but that it should be recreated. In his essay on the claims of politics, Oakeshott warns us of the dangers of slipping too wholly into political activism. In fact, Oakeshott believes that political activity involves a corruption of consciousness from which a society has continuously to be saved. I haven't read the work of Robert Nisbet in an extensive way, but I really look forward to doing that. I think that in Grace Goodell's remarks yesterday, much of what Nisbet said is echoed here in Oakeshott's sentiments. Oakeshott's point is to warn us against suborning the work of the poet and the artist and the philosopher to the needs of the political. To ask them to provide a program for political or other social action or an incentive or inspiration for such action is to require them to be false to their own genius and to deprive society of a necessary service. Conservatives discuss with concern the apparent underrepresentation of conservative values in art, television programming, film, and many popular forms of music and literature. While there are certainly exceptions to be found in each of these cases, most of us would agree that much of popular culture fails to capture our commitments or to celebrate the virtues that we pursue. But before we begin sending conservative activists to infiltrate Hollywood or the New York television studios, I think it's incumbent on us to ask whether this is an appropriate tactic. First, I believe we should ask why more artists, poets, and producers do not seem inspired by our vision. Have we ourselves overly revered political engagement and thereby distracted the natural genius of musicians, novelists, and actors among us? Or have we in our political distraction failed to sample widely enough the creative fruits of our culture and to recognize those which would be sweet to our tastes and to patronize their creators? C.S. Lewis remarks in an essay on Christian apologetics that any Christian who is qualified to write a good popular book on any science may do much more by that than any directly apologetic work. What we want, he added, is not more little books about Christianity, but more little books by Christians on other subjects, with their Christianity latent. I venture to suggest that we replace the adjective Christian here in this quotation with the adjective conservative and take the admonition to heart. Only by engaging ourselves creatively in the full sphere of human activities as our talents and callings draw us on can we truly expect to exert a formative influence on our culture. Certainly, we should find times to come together as conservatives, as we do here at the Philadelphia Society and in other venues. But we also need to find time to be poets and scientists, historians and philosophers, athletes and businessmen, pastors and musicians, and we need to support one another in these roles. At the beginning of my remarks, I suggested that conservatism is a mode of political thought, so let me turn quickly to politics and explain how I think these three themes might appear in the political realm. First of all, roots. Conservative politics has suffered in recent years from a failure to inspire the average American voter. The remedy of this shortcoming may be to return to a more invigorated politics at the grassroots. While our hopeful candidates for president in the year 2000 are busy with expensive fundraising dinners with party elite, and our think tanks are busy outlining and justifying conservative policy positions, the organization and inspiration of American citizens at the grassroots seems to be the expertise of those who oppose us. It's further a shame that they wage successful grassroots campaigns by paying lip service to many of the political values and policies that we ourselves have defined. In addition to reinvigorating the grassroots dimension of our political activities, conservatives should consider more carefully the relevance of politics in the lives of most Americans. While the ideal of American citizenship includes a duty to participate in the political process, for many Americans, their elected representatives seem to have little to do with the face of American government that is most relevant in their daily lives. I refer here to the vast bureaucracy that though faceless in the abstract, is made up of thousands of very real civil servants. Perhaps these are the arms of the Crusader state turned inward on itself, and John ran through a great litany of this, and I'll skip my litany, so it just would be duplicative. The omnipresence of the national bureaucracy as almost a fourth administrative branch of government, as well as a pervasive presence in the lives of American citizens, requires us to consider more carefully how to establish controls and policies for the civil service so that it neither impinges upon our freedoms nor deprives us of opportunities to discharge our duties. Frank Fukuyama, in the most recent edition of the Atlantic Monthly, argues that in an information society, government will not rely as heavily on bureaucratic control and will devolve power to the people, essentially. But I don't think we've seen substantial decentralization or reduction in force of the national bureaucracy as yet. Many of you in the audience this morning may be appalled at my suggestion that bureaucracy might be turned to some useful end. But I believe we must take the attitude of realists and recognize that the administrative state is with us, it is a force, so we can choose to leave it for bad or do what we can to shape it into something better. Actually, I sometimes sense that conservative criticism of the bureaucratic state waxes and wanes with our political fortunes. Today, we tend to lament less that government is big than that it is not ours. Many conservatives happily served their country as civil servants during the Reagan and Bush administrations, and are now frustrated most by no longer controlling the administrative wheels. This itself is cause for self-examination within the conservative movement, for history reveals political patronage to be potentially one of the most corrupting of political forces. Turning briefly to the need for recreation in politics, I believe that we are overdue for some creative thinking. Because political activism is not my calling, I'm not sure what this recreation of politics might look like. But I am certain that it will require that we utilize innovative means of communication more effectively in the effort to convey our political values. Perhaps this more effective communication will involve abandoning the tired spokespersons of our movement in favor of fresh voices and faces about which the public has not yet had time to become cynical. Unfortunately, the only personality that I can think of at the moment who has the potential to be listened to by a majority of Americans is Louis the Budweiser Lizard. I gave it a lot of thought, but maybe we shouldn't rule Louis out too quickly. He obviously understands the importance of family and tradition, and I think there are signs that he may be willing to cooperate with the frogs in a higher cause. Moving to a conclusion, I'd like to suggest that there is another reason for the conservative mission in the 21st century to pursue the complementary needs for roots, relevance, and recreation. That reason is that these themes themselves offer hope for a continuing fusion of the disparate elements of the conservative movement. Traditionalists and social conservatives may often find themselves most occupied in the discovery and transmission of our roots. Economic conservatives and libertarians, on the other hand, inspired by Hayek, Schumpeter, Friedman, and Kirchner to embrace the values of creative destruction, may be most willing to examine our traditions with a spirit of entrepreneurship and to remind us to value the spontaneous creations of the marketplace. Many conservatives have wondered whether the old fusion, at times held together only by the unifying presence of common enemies, could survive the end of the Cold War and the victory of global capitalism. As we watch today's regional conflicts, these victories may look less secure, and we may find it expedient to continue our cooperation. But I believe that common enemies will be a less powerful glue for us in the long run than embracing the possibility of creating a living conservative culture relevant in the lives of all Americans. As we look to the coming century, I'm hopeful that the Philadelphia Society will continue to be a place where we can renew our efforts at fusion, where we can celebrate and examine our roots, where we can build strategies for creating relevance, and where we can recreate conservatism to keep it a breathing force in our culture. Thank you.
I'm going to reject the temptation to thank you for your pregnant remarks.